It's time to sit down and relax for the good, the bad, and the sequel Q&A with your host, Doug.
Hey there, Doug here. The next movie that we're covering is Terror Toons 3. So that means we have to interview somebody that was an actor, maybe a director, maybe a producer. Maybe they did special effects. And we have somebody that did all of that. And it's the amazing Joe Castro. Joe Castro has been doing special effects ever since he found a magazine at a very young age. And with the support of his family, he got a camcorder when they were super expensive. And from reading instructions in these monster magazines, he started, you know, making all these masks and these molds and just creating things that are real scary with his friends and doing these little movies and changed his life. You know, he was able to win a contest, meet some of his heroes, and then years later, he's creating a cult classic called Terror Toons. And that movie came out in 2002, and for $2,300, he was able to make a movie, and then it was in every Blockbuster in America. And he has some great stories about his journey, and he is super busy right now with a lot of special effects works and movies he's working on, and I know you're going to like him. And he actually has a movie that's in every Walmart in America right now called Xenophobia, and it's pretty neat. So check it out. I'll put all the links to all of his stuff where you can follow him and where you can check out that movie. All right. So ladies and gentlemen, this is Joe Castro. Yeah. So where did it all begin for you?
Oh, where did my career in special effects and all that begin for me?
Well, even before that, so we're like, where'd you grow up?
And well, you know, I grew up in a small town in Texas, Helotes, Texas, like population like 1,400 growing up. Wow. I remember the sign said 1,400 when we would drive into San Antonio. It was just north west of San Antonio.
Okay.
And so it was about 25 minutes from San Antonio, but I grew up on a big, giant goat ranch. And we had 55 acres of property, and my grandparents had like a general store on the property. We had a giant barn, and we had a slaughterhouse on the property.
Whoa.
And I, you know, I grew up with a very interesting childhood. You know, when I was 12 years old, my parents bought me the first video camera that was on the retail market.
No way. I wonder how much that was back then.
It was $2,200.
Whoa.
And I know that because my father was a sales rep on phone sales rep. You know, when he used to call you on the phone and sell stuff to you because there was no internet where you could buy anything. So my father sold drafting equipment for like commercial properties. You know, when they build buildings and stuff, he sold the equipment they used to actually make all those maps and designs and stuff and all that stuff with. As soon as computers came in and the computer programs of how they could do that on, you know, in a computer now, he lost his job and he became a goat farmer full time. And my mother was a school teacher. So between the two of them, they, and I believe with some help from my grandparents as well. My grandparents were very successful. They had a very successful business. They bought me, the very first camcorder, which was a battery pack, and you would literally carry the VHS body of the VCR on you, with a strap around your shoulder, and then it was hooked to a video camera. And I was 12 at the time, and you know, that's where it kind of all began. All that same year, you know, I got a book that taught me how to make a rubber mask. It was a magazine, actually. It's a magazine called Cinemagic, and what you could do is you could get a subscription to this magazine. This magazine was basically put together by other special effects artists. They wanted to break into the motion picture industry. So it was a very independent kind of magazine. And the special effects artists that read the magazine also would send in letters to the magazine. And if you had an interesting story about how you went about making a special effect, they would print it in the magazine. So I got to meet a lot of other special effects artists all over the country that way.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You can still, I'm sure if you Google Cinemagic, online. In fact, I know if you Google Cinemagic online, you will find the very issue I bought. It was issue number 6.
Issue number 6. Wow.
On the cover, it says, "Bring your alien to life." And it has a picture of a man. It looks like he's being worked on by an alien with a man with a rubber mask on. And basically it had step-by-step instructions in that magazine of how to produce your very first rubber mask, full head rubber mask.
So what got you into that? Was there like a movie that you saw, or what made your parents know that you wanted that video camera?
Well, that is a very good question. And I have a very specific answer for that. Sweet. Basically, what happened was, growing up, I wanted to be a paleontologist. When I was very young, I was very interested in dinosaurs and dragons. So I thought it would be cool to dig up dinosaur bones. This is when I was like, you know, 6, 7 years old. And I have no idea why I was so intense back then.
Maybe it was Land of the Lost.
It wasn't Land of the Lost yet. I actually didn't watch Land of the Lost much. That wasn't my thing. But what happened was, I don't even know where the dragon thing came from. I think it had a lot to do with the fact that dragons were made out of paper mache, Chinese dragons.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of material and information in books about using paper mache to make art, make dragons, and make things like that. And I do know that there was a book that was written by Alan Orbsey, who was the special effects artist with Tom Savini on a whole bunch of his earlier films.
Okay.
And Alan, let me see here. Alan, I want to make sure. Ormsey is how you spell his last name. Alan wrote a book. You can find him on Facebook, Alan. He's my friend on Facebook. Alan had written a book called, I want to say, How to Make a Monster. How to Make a Monster, something like this, something similar to this. And I bought it in fifth grade from the book club at the at my library in my elementary school. And in that book, it taught you how to make like a paper mache Frankenstein hat that you could put on your head. You know, you put like a paper lunch bag, like a brown paper lunch bag on your head. Yeah. You trim it around your ears so it fits on top of your head like Frankenstein. And he gave like step-by-step instructions. So it one thing led to another. You know, paper mache art, paper mache dragons, and then the dragons turned into dinosaurs. And then what happened was, one Saturday afternoon, my father showed me this movie that would change my entire world. And because my father was my biggest cheerleader at the time, he was my biggest supporter, and he knew that I would like it. And it was Godzilla versus the Smog Monster.
Oh, nice.
And if you've never seen the film, it's considered the darkest Godzilla film of all of them. And it's because Godzilla almost dies in the movie. And they show people actually being killed on camera by the other monster that Godzilla's fighting. The Smog Monster sprays like this acid fumes in the air, and literally everybody's skin deteriorates in the film and they turn into skeletons. So there's makeup effects, there's creatures, there's miniatures. You know, you got Godzilla's rotoscope breath in it. There was a little bit of every aspect of special effects in that film. And when that movie was over, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. You know, and it was very clear that I wanted to make monsters and make special effects for movies.
That's so awesome. So from you getting that camera, what was your next step to like achieve that dream, since you had your eye on the prize? What was that next step that you were able to take?
Well, you know, what happened was, after I got the video camera, and I had the magazine that taught me how to make a rubber mask, I was able to make short films and put my makeup effects into short films. You know, the natural course of events. I'd write my own short films, and then I'd shoot them with my friends, and I'd put my friends in the movies and kill them. And, you know, like most young people do these days when they have a video camera, they make a slasher film. But at the time, you know, there was only a handful of people around the country that were doing this. It's not like today where everybody has a video camera on their phone.
Yeah.
What happened was, let me see. Tom Savini was very accessible at the time. Back in 1982, 83, 84, you could literally call the area code of the state city or state you were trying to reach. Let's say Philadelphia, where Tom Savini lives. And then I would call the 411 operator, and the area code plus 411, I think it was.
Yeah.
And then that operator would answer the phone. So the Pittsburgh 411, which was information, would pick up, and I'd say, "May I please have the number to Tom Savini?" And they'd say, "Spell his last name," and I'd give it to them, and they'd give me Tom Savini's home phone number.
Oh, man.
And I could call him on the phone, and I could talk to him for hours. And Tom was very nice to me. You know, I was a young kid, and he spoke to me on several occasions, and you know, he taught me how to use a chemical fire extinguisher and load compressed air into it to spray blood. He taught me several things over the phone. He was a very kind man, very knowledgeable, and so he was a big influence in the beginning. And you know, I just reached out to different people, you know, people in that magazine. There were other special effects artists throughout the country, and I read a lot of information in books and magazines. Taught myself how to use the different special effects materials that were talked about in Fangoria. Even Fangoria had in-depth interviews with special effects artists. They don't do that anymore in Fangoria, which is something I miss, and they need to bring back. Basically, what happened was I won a national special effects makeup contest at the age of 15, and they flew me out to Los Angeles, and I met with Forrest G. Ackerman. If you're not familiar with who Forrest G. Ackerman is, Forrest G. Ackerman is the very first sci-fi horror fan ever. And that's because he coined the phrase sci-fi. So whenever you see sci-fi written down, that's a coined phrase. That's why the Sci-Fi Network doesn't spell it that way, because they don't have permission to use it. So Forrest had the very first horror magazine ever. It was called Famous Monsters of Filmland. And then he did an offshoot of that magazine called Monsterland. And he had a national special effects contest in that. He had to be under the age of 18, though, to enter it. And I was 15 at the time. And I entered my makeup effect. And Joe Dante, I don't know if you're familiar with Joe Dante.
I've heard that name, yeah.
Joe Dante directed The Howling, and he directed Gremlins.
Oh, yeah.
And John Carl Beekler, who recently passed away last year, he directed Troll, and he directed a whole Friday 13th Part 7 and a whole bunch of slew of films. Both of those two, one of them is a famous, well, they're both famous directors, but one of them is a special effects artist. Between the two of them, they chose the winner of the contest, and they chose my work as the winner of the contest. So they flew me out to LA, and I got to meet all these nice people, and I was introduced to Brink Stevens and Dave Dakota and Saban Gray from the magazine. And, Brink Stevens is one of my best friends now. Brink Stevens is a screen queen. Brink Stevens is a screen queen. She's been in over 200 movies, and I use her in every one of my films that I direct. And she's one of my personal good friends. She lives about a mile and a half from my house now.
Oh, cool.
And, it's a small world. You know, we all kind of work together and play together out here in L.A., and we all support each other. But, yeah, it was my introduction to L.A. at the age of 15. And, as soon as I was able to move out of Texas, I hightailed it over here to L.A., and I've been over here ever since, you know.
What was that like at the age of 15, especially you talked about your town of 1,400 people? Was that like just eye-opening, just the whole experience?
You mean coming out here to L.A.?
Yeah, that'd be a big deal.
It was. It was the first time I'd ever been on an airplane, actually, you know, and it was a big deal. My family had other plans for my career. I don't think they really wanted me. I honestly, deep down, I don't know that my mother really wanted me to succeed at doing the art thing. She had other plans for me. And my father made me promise to him that I would always chase my dreams. My father passed away in a horrible car accident in 97. But in 1989, he asked me, he made me promise him that I would never stop chasing my dreams. So I never have. And that's what I've been doing ever since, you know.
Man, it's so powerful, especially when you have the support like that and hear those kind of words from your parent. And, you know, that's really powerful.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when did you end up heading out there? So what year were you in L.A.?
It was 89. In 89, I drove out to L.A. with a good friend of mine also wanted to work in special effects. And we loaded up our cars and a U-Haul and brought our beds over, you know, that kind of thing when you first move out of the house. And that friend lasted 3 months, and then he moved back to Texas. And then I just want to say the first year I lived in L.A. in my apartment, I had 9 different roommates from Texas that all came and left, except with the exception of one that stayed. Yeah.
They were volume 9. Stay for like, yeah, I'm here to stay for a long time, Joe. And they're out next week.
Yeah. Yeah. They would stay for, they would last like a month and a half. And it was, you know, it's just a totally different world than it is over there.
No,
Yeah. You know, and, you know, I mean, and if you're not chasing a dream, like really chasing something specific, I can see where it would be very difficult to be here and live here in LA if you're not really in the industry and you're being transplanted over here. Yeah, I think something like, I heard a statistic, and this was like 20 years ago, like 100,000 people move to LA every year to join the film industry. And like, I don't know, something like 80,000 of them move back home within the first year.
Oh my God.
You know, it's just the worst.
I interviewed a guy, his name's Kevin Kilner. He's been like a bunch of stuff, but he is like on, he's on like the board for SAG. And he told me like the most disturbing stat. It was like, he told me how many people were in SAG and it was like a staggering high number. And then when he told me how many people can actually live off of it, it was like insane. It was like in the like 13,000-14,000. And I'm like, that's insane. I feel like the number can work.
You mean they can work like consistent? Yeah, they work consistent. Most of them turn into to be FICOR, which is basically they can still work SAG, but they can also work non-union, and then they can, but they can't vote like for the SAG awards or something.
Okay. When he told me that, I was like, oh my, that's insane. But so then from there, 89, the first credit that's on your IMDb, and I know this is never 100%, it has you doing special effects for Teenage Exorcist and makeup.
Yeah. The very first credit, and it's not on there. I guess it's not on there. It's actually a movie called Evil Tunes. That should be on there.
Really? Evil Tunes?
I don't know. I mean, I to be honest with you, I didn't put any of those things up there, so I need to go and fix it. But the very first movie I ever did, I got credit for here in LA, was a movie called Evil Tunes. And that was a Fred Olen Ray movie that I did the special effects for.
Whoa, that looks wild. I'm looking at the cover right now.
And I got to work with David Carradine in that.
Oh,
and Artie Johnson, and
that's awesome.
You know, a whole bunch of people. It's funny because one of my dad's favorite movies of actually his favorite movie of all time was this movie called Lone Wolf McQuaid, and it stars Lone Wolf McQuaid. Anyways, Chuck Norris. It stars Chuck Norris and David Carradine.
Oh,
and
nice.
So Chuck Norris fights David Carradine in it. And it was like my dad's like, he probably watched it, I don't know, 40, 50 times. He had it on VHS. Anyways, I couldn't stand that film because he watched it so much. But when he saw a picture of me and David Carradine together on a movie set working together, you know, he was just thrilled. I totally made his whole day. I mean, it was all worthwhile to him.
That's so awesome. So you did the animation. You drew the animation over the people. Did you help with that?
No, I actually made a practical book, this book, like the Necronomicon, with a face on the front of it. And it was mechanical. So the book talked. It was like a mechanical book you could actually open. And there were drawings on the pages. And the front of the book had a face on it that was mechanical to talk. And then I made like creature teeth for the lead, a female villain.
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah. And then there were like some bites that she bites people on the neck with. I think I made this book that like one of the books that burns at the end and stuff bubbles up out of the face, the eyes. And, I did some goofy kind of like spooky, Necronomicon effects in it with some saw. I did all the practical effects and I didn't do any of the rotoscoping or the animation.
But that looks pretty cool. It's funny. I just interviewed I interviewed a few months ago. It was the last episode I put out, but I interviewed Michael Grace and he wrote Poltergeist 1 and 2, but he wrote Cool World, and it's like right around the same time. And it's like, not like it's the same movie, but it's pretty cool seeing the animation like on top of the actors, especially back then. It's pretty neat.
Right. Funny story about Poltergeist was a huge influence in life growing up. Yeah, Poltergeist was a really huge influence. So he wrote Poltergeist 1 and 2.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big controversy behind that, behind the first Poltergeist. Supposedly it was originally drafted by a gentleman, and how it ended up in Steven Spielberg's lap and Toby Hooper's lap is supposed to be some huge controversy behind it. I don't know all the details of it, but that movie was a big influence in my life. Yeah. Oh, I'm just, you know what I'm going to do? I found the book. It's called Movie Monsters, Monsters Makeup and Monster Shows to Put On. It was a book that I bought, and I went to Alan's page, and it's there in Alan Ormsey's page on Facebook. Anyways, that was a great book to start off with for a young person. I mean, I was probably 7 or 8 when I got this, maybe even 10 years old. But that's one of the makeup special effects books where I learned how to do kind of monstery kind of makeup with. And Alan wrote it, and now he's my friend on Facebook, which is amazing that I could reach out to this man that inspired me to as a young person and help with my career, you know?
Yeah, that is pretty wild. So going back to Teenage Exorcist, so it's kind of cool. Brink Stevens, who you met 6 years earlier when you won that contest, she starred in that movie.
That's right. See how it's amazing. Like I found that now, like over the years, the more I interact with people in the industry, and you can't be shy about it. You know, you really got to grab the bull by the horn. You know, even if you can just reach over across the table and shake their hand or touch them, but somehow the universe just brings you all together. And everybody that I encountered in my childhood, I've somehow ended up working with them, become best friends with them, or in some way I'm connected with them, you know, and they've been an integral part of my career. Brink has become an integral part of my life. And I just think she's fantastic at everything she does. She directed a movie that my partner, Steven Escobar, and I produced that hopefully will be coming out within the next year. It's called Personal Demons. And it's her directorial debut. My partner, Steven, and I hired her to write, produce, and star in her first directorial feature. Yeah.
That's pretty awesome.
And so it's pretty exciting. It's a pretty exciting piece of work. And I'm looking forward to everybody seeing it. I know she's got a lot of new directing stuff on her plate. It's been a long time coming for her, but you know, she's been in 200 films. I think she knows something about directing, and I hope to see more movies from her. Yeah.
No, that's pretty awesome. And then I don't know if you got into talking with Steve Joyner about it, but he works with Eddie Deason too, and Eddie was in.
That's right.
Yeah, that's pretty
that's
neat.
That's right. Yeah. For Teenage Exorcist, I made the main demon character, and then the main demon character's demise at the end. I think his head gets cut off or something, and I made a decapitated head with these big bulgy eyeballs. I made some zombie stuff for it, and it's been a while since I've seen the film, but I remember it was like I get a call on Thursday and they need it all on Monday, you know.
Wow.
Back then it was just like everything just happened fast, and I remember sitting in my little apartment in Van Nuys, California, my little one bedroom on my dining room table, sculpting demon faces and sculpting zombie faces, and then running them over to the shop to have them cooked in foam. Or I don't know, I might've even have cooked the foam in my apartment, which is a big no-no. No one does that now, but
yeah.
When you're 19 years old and you want to break into the film industry, you do just about anything, you know?
Oh, definitely.
But yeah, that was a good times, you know, that's a good times.
No. And then from there, not too long after that, that's when you directed and you did the special effects for Ceremony. That was your first movie, right?
That was my first feature. Yeah, Ceremony was my directorial debut with it was a shot on 35mm Panavision motion picture.
That's cool.
And for most young people today, they have no idea what that means, and they don't care either. I mean, you know, we have red cameras, we have Aries and other stuff that's almost it's good if not better. But it was a big deal. Like, you could not make a movie in 1993 unless you had money, you know, unless you had the means. Because a movie had to be shot on film. You had to have a film camera to shoot it with. You had to be able to develop the film, process it through a, you know, some sort of film, motion picture film developing company. Our film was developed at Photocam over in Burbank. And then you had to have a place to store the film while it was being edited. You couldn't just keep it in your house, you know. And it was a big deal. And it cost a lot of money to make a movie. I think we spent something like $75,000 on the film stock alone, the film stock and developing of the film of the film alone, and that's kind of a big deal. Today, you make these kids, young people, make whole movies for $5,000 or whatever. I that was my first film. My second film was Legend of the Chupacabra that Troma Entertainment put out. But my third film, I shot the whole movie for $2,300. And it was my most successful film to date. It's called a movie called Terror Tunes.
Yeah, that and was $2,300?
I shot the whole movie for $2,300. I shot it at my boss's house in Van Nuys, California at the time in 2001. And we shot it over Easter weekend. It was a Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday. And the first day we shot was a 12-hour day. The second day was a 17-hour day. And then the third day was a 25-hour day. And I remember clearly because it was Monday morning when we finished shooting. And we could hear people outside starting their cars up to go to work, to their real jobs. And we had been shooting an entire weekend. We had been shooting for 25 hours. Wow. And we were getting ready to kill the main villain in the end of the film, and the birds were chirping, and people were having their morning coffee and getting ready to go to work, and we were finishing making this this bloody killer cartoon movie. And but that movie was been my most successful film to date. There were 8 copies of that film and on VHS, and 8 copies on DVD in every Blockbuster in America. And you do the math. I don't even know how many stores there had in America at the time, but I do know that they moved something like 50,000 units in the first 2 weeks alone.
Whoa.
And I made the move for $2,300.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
That is insane. I looked at the trailer for the movie, because what we do on our podcast, we always like to talk movie sequels. It's called The Good, The Bad, and The Sequel, because I've always been fascinated with the sequel, with like, how do you go from 1 to 2 or 1 to 3,
right?
Or so I think it's fascinating.
From 1 to 2, after 1 did so well, a producer that I knew approached me and said, "Hey Joe, I would like to pay for part 2 to be made, you know." And he said, "I'd like to put a little bit more money into it." And so part 2 was made, and I had an outside influence. It needed to look a certain way. It had more of a commercial feel to it. The first one's a very kind of dark, gritty cult film.
Yeah.
And the second one was made with a little bit more money. I think we made it for like $13,000. It didn't have a successful domestic release. The person that was distributed, our producer, who also acted as the part distributor, he passed on a really good offer at the time. He didn't know what good money was when it came to getting money up front. And, at the time, you could get about $25,000 up front for a shot on video feature. And we made the movie for $13,000, and they gave us, I think they offered us $50,000 up front, and he passed on it.
Oh, man.
And today you'll never get $50,000 up front for a shot on video feature. But back then you could. And, he passed on that, and that was probably the worst mistake he'd ever made. And but he gave the movie to my partner and I, Steven, and we put it out on our own. And it had its own life eventually. But I don't think it's the most popular of the franchise. And we just released the third one about 3 years ago.
Oh,
and
cool.
It stars Herschel Gordon Lewis. He's in it. And that movie had a great response with the film festivals. It's probably one of a film that I'm most proud of. It's like my masterpiece, actually. But it had a very limited release, so a lot of people haven't seen it. And if you love Terror Tunes, if you love the first one, you're gonna love part 3. And the fans that have seen it really, really enjoy it. It's like basically a 75-minute special effects shot. It took us 6 years to make the film.
Whoa.
The first film was shot in 3 days for $2,300. The second one we shot in 7 days for $13,000. And the third one, it took me 6 years to put together. And it's like one big, long special effects shot. Like I said, the whole film is like a visual overload. The whole thing is very stylized, and every bit of it was done intentionally, and it's done with a lot of finesse and with a lot of technique and a lot of skill. Yeah.
No, you know what? Well, maybe we'll check that one out. You know what's funny? So when I look at the first one, I watch the trailer, and this is just me being when I'm 33. So in 2002, Beverly Lynn was in a lot of like those late night, like Cinemax or Showtime movies. And I'm like,
yes,
I know her. And then I looked at her IMDb and I'm like, oh my God, I remember looking up that one movie on demand, like on Comcast, like back in the day. But that was cool. You had
and
her.
Beverly's actually, yeah, actually got Beverly and Lizzie Borden and a lot of people from the original cast to come back and be in part three. So it's a really cool reunion. If you're a real big fan of the first film, most of the cast from the first film is in the third one.
That's cool.
They make appearances in it. And Beverly and I are still very close. I'm still very close with Lizzie Borden and Carrie Lou from the first film. It was definitely an adventure. No one knew that it was going to take off like it did. I guess it was kind of a one of a kind thing. And when Blockbuster picked it up, it went everywhere and everybody got to see it. And it found its own, a fan base. I love finding fan art online from the characters from the film. And we still have a big support of it. Yeah.
I know there's a lot of options now for like horror films to be able to like, you know, there's Shudder and there's so many like streaming apps you could like look at movies, but I really miss like going to Blockbuster like as a kid or after work. And I used to love
right.
like,
and there's looking so at the, yeah, many and looking,
cover art.
Yeah. No, I hear you loud and clear. It was definitely cool to see what everybody was doing and to be able to check out. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, me and my wife, I'm from New Jersey. We're back in New Jersey, but we lived in Portland, Oregon for 3 years. And at the time there was like one of five or six Blockbusters like left in America. Now there's only I think there's only one in Alaska, but it was cool.
One in Alaska. Huh?
Yeah. It was cool just to go in it and like that experience of like seeing that cover art, picking it out. And then maybe like the cover art was like good. And that was the only good part of it, but it was cool picking out movies like that, especially horror.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. It was definitely an experience. I mean, you could spend 30 minutes in there just looking around it.
Oh yeah.
And all the stuff. And it gave it, you know, it was more difficult for not just anybody could put out a film. You know, the film had to have criteria and it had to meet certain guidelines and it had to, in order to make it to that shelf. And so, you know, you'd weed out a lot of bad stuff, a lot of stuff that is, I think there's a lot of fluff online these days. You know, there's a lot of stuff that it's not watchable. There's a lot of stuff that's just not watchable, you know, and it's like going to buy a new song. You know, if you go to, I mean, a lot of people use these streaming services where they just listen to music, but try going to buy new music at random today on iTunes or something like that. And you'll never be able to find anything new because the market is just flooded with so much stuff, you know? I really used to enjoy the fact that I could get my films, each one of my films in the Blockbuster. And, you know, it was definitely a bad boys club when you got your movie into a Blockbuster or Hollywood Video
or cool.
Netflix, you know? Yeah. Right. Yep.
So one of the things I'm going to ask you about other things real quick, but one thing that caught my eye when I looked at like your bio is the Summer Massacre.
Yeah.
The Guinness Book World Record. That is something. Is that, what was the record before that? Did you know?
I think it was like 53, like through 53 kills. And my partner and I set out to get that record. And you know, people think, oh, it was very difficult to do. It wasn't
as easy as you think. There were a lot of specs involved, and but we I set out to do that, and we did it, you know, and it was kind of a big deal for us at the time, and it still is today. I'm really proud of it. I sat at the computer for about 11 months while we were making that film, producing all the kills and all the gore. And I put myself through CGI school to make that film happen. It was no small feat, you know. It took a lot of work. It was a lot of work involved to make that happen.
So over the years, is there like a particular, obviously creating your own film and getting into Blockbuster is like such a huge accomplishment, but is there another movie that you worked on over the years, like whether it be like visual effects or special effects, that you were like, when you saw the end product of what you created, that you were like, wow, I can't believe that.
Well, we just released our 18th feature film, and it's titled Xenophobia. And I've been wanting to make that movie for 20 years. So I've been wanting to make that movie even before Terror Toons.
Oh, wow.
Xenophobia is the very first ever alien abduction anthology movie. I always try to do first, you know, Guinness Book of World Record, the first killer cartoon movie, you know, the highest body count. You know, I'm always trying to do something truly original. It's very hard to get a mainstream audience to take a bite on and appreciate something new. You know, I always use this as an example. Have you ever had a everything bagel with smoked lox, cream cheese, capers, cucumbers, onion, and tomato?
No, I have not. But you would make that.
But you see, it's like the first time someone stuck that in my face and said, "Here, have a bite." I'm like, I'm not going to eat that. You know, and 15 years later, I finally took a bite. And I was like, oh my gosh, why did I wait so long to eat it? It was amazing. It was like crack for your mouth. It was so good.
That's awesome.
And that is what I like to do when I'm making a movie. You know, people go online and they'll review my films and they'll say, oh, it's crap. It's this. It's not. It doesn't look like all everybody else's movie. So it can't be good. And but that's not what I'm trying for. I'm trying to do something completely unique. So we made this alien abduction anthology film, and I'm very proud of it. It's a very commercial film. It got in, I mean, it's in Walmart, for God's sake.
Really?
How much more commercial can you get? How much more commercial can you get than that?
Yeah.
It's in every Walmart in America. And it stars a really, really good cast of people. And it stars Manu Itarami. He's one of the actors from Star Trek Voyager. And,
okay.
Let's see, Kristen Renton from Sons of Anarchy is in it. Kelly Ryder from Sons of Anarchy is in it. Nick Principe he plays Chrome Skull from the Laid to Rest movies. It's a horror film. He's the guy that wears that chrome skull mask and kills people. Anyway, yeah, Nick Principe is in it. Anyways, it has got an all-star cast in it, and it has all practical alien effects in the film. And then the only digital effects in the movie are the spaceship stuff I did. I did all the spaceship stuff myself. But if you love like Star Wars, practical aliens, like the cantina scene, and you like with a little bit of horror edge to it, sci-fi with a little horror, like from the 80s, you're going to love this movie. And the movie is actually PG-13. But to be honest with you, there's some stuff in it I think they would probably have given it an R rating back in the 80s. But things are so different today. I mean, I go on regular broadcast television. Have you ever seen that show? I think it's called The Good Doctor. And it's about the doctor. I think he's like mentally challenged doctor.
He has autism.
Yeah. And they show like full, like open heart surgery in that. There was a scene this guy had gotten stabbed by a swordfish, and they pulled the swordfish out of his leg, and blood started pumping out of the artery in his leg, and a woman stuck her finger in that hole to stop the bleeding, and they showed all of it. Like, it's not even slightly hidden on camera. You would never get away with doing that, you know, back in the 80s or 90s. So my point is that there's some pretty graphic stuff in it too, even though it's PG-13. So I'm very proud of the film Xenophobia, and you know, I've been wanting to make it for 20 years, and all the stars aligned last year. My partner, Steven Escobar, and another good friend of mine who's also a talented director. His name is Thomas Churchill. All three of us together wrote, produced, and directed the film. It was three directors. And we all had our own portion of the film, but we all were on the same page. We even had two directors of photography because we shot a portion of the movie in Los Angeles and a portion of the movie in Texas. And even the two directors of photography collaborated and spoke to each other and showed each other's work. So that way it all had a uniform feel to it.
That's awesome.
And it was a very wonderful collaborative effort with a lot of really talented, nice people. And I'm very proud of the movie. Yeah, for sure.
So when
go out
is,
and check that out.
No, I'm gonna, yeah, I just put it on my watch list. So Terror Toons 4 and 5, are those done already?
Yes. They're already shot and in the can. But remember, it took me 6 years to put out part 3.
Yeah.
And the truth is Terror Toons, like the tagline for part 3 on the movie poster, it says, in the cartoon dimension, anything is possible. And you know, when I'm making these films, there's no formula for a cartoon. Anything is possible. And when I'm the director and I'm the special effects artist creating it, there's no limitation. So when I get down to the act of post-production and I start putting this stuff together, it's like reinventing the film all over again. It's like rewriting the script all over again. Anything is possible. And it takes a while. It takes a while to get through that in post-production. So part four has been sitting on, well, four and five has been sitting on my partner's drives now for almost 7 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's been in the can. Yeah, we shot 3, 4, and 5 back to back. And we're going to get it out. We're going to get it done. We're going to get it out. Like I said, I'll also bring Steven's directorial debut is a part of Terror Toons 4.
Oh, and really?
That's already
awesome.
In the can. That's already been done. Yeah. So.
And you have a lot of other things going on, too. Like when you look at your IMDb, you're a pretty busy guy.
I've been very fortunate and very busy over the past 3-4 years. But the past year has been very good to me. I've worked on several projects with Thomas Churchill and with many different directors. Clown Motel is a movie that's out right now. That was directed by Joseph Kelly and is produced by Joseph Kelly and Dave Bailey. It's a very fun film and it's very well received. Let me think of what else came out this year. Xenophobia. I just did this really large creature movie with Thomas Churchill and I can't give any details about it away. I think it's going to be coming out in February of next year. Now, the only thing I can say about it is the creature in the film, when I was approached to make it, this is how it was described to me. Joe, I got to be able to put somebody in its mouth like it can eat them whole. And I was like, okay, I get it. You know, they said picture like Jaws, like when John Shark was on the boat eating the guy. That's what we want to do with it. I was like, okay, cool. So it was the biggest creature I've ever made for a movie, and you know, my good friend Thomas Churchill honored me to make that creature. I can't wait for everybody to see it.
That's so awesome. Is there anybody, since you've been doing this such a long time and you had those great interactions back in '85? Is there anybody that you worked with early on that maybe was, or even recently, that was younger that you like give a shot to and almost mentor? Because you've done so much and you know, you taught yourself CGI and all the special effects.
You know, I'll be honest with you. Wow, that's a really difficult thing to respond to. And only because I have been, I've been a loner for a while, you know. I just let a couple of people into my world. There's very few artists out there that I've been able to successfully collaborate with.
Oh, that's
but
cool.
I think it's only because I have a really clear vision of what I want to do now. And I think when it comes to working with other artists, sometimes if you're not on the same page, it just does not work. I've developed my own formula to successfully navigating a collaborative effort with our director and a producer. And ultimately, as an artist, I think that's one of the areas of an artist's life that is pitted against them. You know, part of being an artist is that you want to be truly original. You want to stand out. You want to be different. You want to be known for your work. And ultimately, when you're working on a motion picture, there's only really one vision, and that's the director's vision. And if you can successfully take what's in the director's head and pull it out and produce it for them, then you've done an amazing job. And over again, I see where other artists fail. Even though they're amazing artists, they're amazing sculptors and they're amazing painters, they just don't have the capability to completely collaborate with the director. And it's not their job to be an artist. It's their job to take what's in the director's head and pull it out and produce it for them, you know. So it's very hard for me to find other artists that are willing to sacrifice their own vision in order to be a team player with the actual director. It's been a long time since I've seen that. And there's a couple of young people that I'm allowing into my world right now that I've been talking to. There's one young man that I recently had come over, and we painted a dead body together, and he's super talented. And the next film that I need a partner to come and create with me, I'm definitely going to hire this young man.
Awesome.
But I'm not going to give any names out right now. But I've been searching for a while, and but there are a couple of people out there that I'm looking forward to working with. Yeah.
Yeah, I respect that. You know, you're looking for the right people. You just don't want to take anybody in because you have a certain vision. And obviously it's working for you. You're super busy and you've done so much in the industry. Most of the time I talk to some people, they don't have their hands in so many different cookie jars, but you've done so many different things. And that's so great for the whole process. You've touched every part of the process.
I think that it's important to have a working knowledge of other departments and other things, because it's like I said, it's more of a collaborative effort. You know, you understand the pitfalls and the trials and tribulations the other departments are going through. You can be the devil's advocate and you can be there as a second voice to the other departments when it's a collaborative effort and you know when there's going to be a mistake made. I can't tell you how many times I've had to ask the director or the producer to trust me and allow me to do what it was that I needed to get done, because I have 37 years experience and they really need to listen to me. So they're not, beating their head against the wall in post-production later on when they realize they've made a mistake. I think that, when it comes to working on a motion picture set, it's very important to be a team player and to respect the fact that there is one vision everybody's trying to work towards.
Yeah, no, that's awesome, man. And this has been great chatting with you. And I always ask people this question, but I know the answer because it's something you've always done from the beginning. So I'm just thankful, and for yourself and people that love your films, that, you know, you got that magazine, you're able to smart enough to call 411 and learn some of those things from Tom. But
if not, you'd
be like working at the Smithsonian right now, working with dinosaur bones. And
I'd be working dinosaurs. That may have been the case. You know, I'm grateful for my father pointing me in the right direction.
Yeah, that's really cool.
If anybody wants to know more about my stuff, you can check me out on Instagram. My handle is Joe_Castro_director. And then, on Facebook, which is where I'm normally, all my pictures are there. You can reach out to me there. Send me a message. It's facebook.com/Joe.Castro. And, everybody go check out Xenophobia, which is basically means the fear of aliens. It's out right now on all the home media platforms, and it's on, it's at every Walmart in America.
Sweet. Yeah. I'll put all the links in there. And, one of your photos, I commented on it, man, you're a pretty jacked dude. You're pretty scary.
Oh, back in the day, when you're working with like 100-pound bags of plaster and you're in the special effects shop, you're doing practical effects, you know, that's a part of the game, man. You gotta be
You got to be tough. And it's kind of a man's, you know, kind of a bad boys club doing special effects work. And there are a lot of very talented women out there, but you know, back in the day in the 80s and 90s, it was a bad boys club, and we had to be buff and we had to be tough. You know, there's a lot of people picking and poking at each other, and it is still very highly competitive these days, and that's it still awesome. Is. So yeah,
thanks for that, Joe, and thanks for chatting. We'll talk again soon.
All right, Doug, thank you so much. Take care.
Wasn't Joe great? Talk about having the support of his family, and he really appreciated that bond that he had with his dad, and he just loves movie making. You could tell that from talking to him. He loves being able to create, and check out his IMDb. He is creating a lot and helping a lot of filmmakers with their special effects over the last couple of years. So, Joe, thanks so much, and tune in this Thursday. We have our review of Terror Toons 3, and we just recorded that today, and that movie was wild. It's on Amazon Prime, so you check it out for free. Actually, Terror Toons 1, 2, and 3 are on Amazon Prime, so if you have a Prime account, check it out. And again, don't forget to review, rate, share our podcast. Follow us on all social media @SequelsOnly. Good night.